Hello and welcome to another episode of The Right Side. It is 8 o'clock on Saturday morning on the West Coast, and I'm already like tired, and worn out from all the news that broke late last night. But I am here as ever with my co-host Kimberly Ross. How are you?
I am fantastic, Andrea Ruth, and it is the first day of fall, so that's a great thing.
I know.
It's even though we have all this crazy news.
I know. I'm actually going to. I was looking at the weather report, and actually I'll mention. So our guest this week is Dallas Morning News editorial board member and columnist Jay Caruso. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great. But what I was going to say is that it's the first full week of fall at the end, and this is the best week of weather in the Pacific Northwest. It's going to be set high of like 68, 70 degrees. The leaves are changing, but there's going to be that cool Christmas in the air. And I'm going to be heading down to a humid and stormy Austin, Texas for Trib Fest this week, where Jay will be moderating a panel. Do you want to plug yourself a little bit, Jay?
Well, I don't want to plug myself. I'll plug the panel that I'm going to be moderating. I will be Friday, 2 p.m. I can't remember exactly where it is, but if anybody's going down there, you have your schedules. I will be talking to four members of the Texas House, and they are also happen to be members of the Texas House Freedom Caucus. And the panel is entitled The Freedom Caucus Wish List. So we're going to, the next legislative session begins in January 2019. And so we'll be talking about, you know, what they're going to want to do and what they're going to want to get passed, all that good stuff.
Yeah, I know the national, I don't know about the Texas delegation of the Freedom Caucus, but I know that the National House Freedom Caucus has been a lot of do not want lately. But Kim, why don't you do some shameless promotion of our podcast?
Yes, you need to go to therightside.us and check out all the past podcasts that we've done. We've had some great guests. We've had Randy Barnett, Georgetown Law Professor. He talked about the nomination like a long time ago when we had first talked about the nomination, and it seems like that's all we've been doing for the past few months because that's the only news in town, apparently. I'm not, you know, exasperated by that fact or anything. We've also had Bridget Fedesi on the show. We've had, oh my gosh, Casey Maddox. How did I forget his name? We had him on the show, and he, of course, talked about the Supreme Court stuff. So you should go to our website, look at these previous podcasts we've done, click subscribe, and you can see that in the upper right corner. Or just go to iTunes and subscribe. And when you're there, leave a review of our show. And, of course, please leave 5 stars because that's what we're worth.
Yes,
correct?
Exactly. We know it's Mika Brzezinski on MSNBC always does that know your worth thing. We know our worth already.
But, we do.
Value.
Yeah, know your value. Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, so we were going to try and get through an entire pod. We was like, okay, we've done 2 Kavanaugh podcasts, but we have Jay Caruso, the diva, who insisted, and honestly, I don't know how we could have, with everything that's gone on this week and everything that broke last night, I don't know. Jay insisted that he wanted to at least do a recap of Kavanaugh, and I don't see how we could have.
We'll allow it.
Yes, because I think we'd probably be irrelevant. But we do have other things to talk about, because Jay is there in Dallas, and last night there was the Beto cruise, the first of 3 debates, so we'll get into that. But first, Jay, Kavanaugh, Christine Blasey Ford, is it Blasey or Blasey? She has another 5th extension on saying whether or not she will. So how much are you, I don't want to get into her credibility, unless you want to talk about her credibility, which we, you know, but I don't really want to talk about that. But just now that we're getting into the demand, the concessions that Chuck Grassley, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, conducting these hearings, he has tried to bend over backwards. So what has been your kind of like feeling on what's going on with Christine Blasey Ford, the Democrats, and her lawyers? With her kind of peccadilloes, I guess, on what she wants to do.
Oh, it's been the whole thing has just been ridiculous. This constant thing, you know, you would almost think it was coordinated between if not Ford, her attorney, and Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, because, you know, first of all, she doesn't really have the right to, like, she can be heard if she wants to be heard. But this whole idea is that they're not allowed to, like, that she's supposed to, that she can sit there and, like, issue a set of demands that she wants. And if those aren't met, then she's not going to testify. And, of course, one of the most ridiculous ones is that she wants Kavanaugh to testify first and then she'll go, which is absurd. People could sit there and say this is not a courtroom, but it doesn't matter. The accuser goes first. The accused goes second so he can defend himself. It is just asinine for him to go and sit there and answer questions about a bunch of things when he doesn't even know exactly what she's going to say.
Right. So he would just be answering media reports and things like that. And it is the basic essence. It's the basic essence of American jurisprudence that the accuser, that the plaintiff goes first and the defendant gets to defend himself. So you have to have on the record accusations that aren't just media reports.
Right. And the idea, again, that this, the people who sit there and say this is different. This isn't a courtroom. This is a job interview. Well, it doesn't matter. We're still talking about the same overall principle. The other thing that she demanded is that there not be a counsel that asks her questions. This is a pure political play, because what would happen is the Judiciary Committee would likely bring in a woman who would ask the questions, because they've already been talking about several people bringing them in, women, former senators, governors, whatever, who are also attorneys to ask these questions. Because the media and everybody has already played up this whole angle. Oh, what's it going to look like if 11 white men are sitting there, you know, talking to this woman and you know, making accusations and asking her questions? It's going to look terrible. So they purposely sit there and say, well, we want to make sure that you have the thing that is going to have the worst optics of everything there. You can't have a counsel brought in to ask questions. Again, that's an absurd demand. And basically, you know, just I don't want to go into detail all the other ones, but essentially what they've done here is they've set it up so that she can find a reason not to testify and then say, you know, they just weren't going to be fair to me and it wouldn't have mattered. And the Democrats can go along, you know, caterwauling and whining about it. You know, I mean, stupid, you know, the what's her name from New York?
Kristen Gillibrand.
Gillibrand, who's going around saying having her come to speak is silencing her. I mean, to think about the logic in that one.
Well, you know? Kristen's not very logical, because she did say this week, I believe her. It rings true to me, which I think is the laziest argument when you're trying to talk about facts and black and white.
Yeah, well, that was the same thing they did with the Michael Wolff book.
If it rings true, it is true.
You know,
I think Jonah Goldberg, wait, one last thing. Jonah Goldberg had the best thing about this when he said, you know, because people were talking about, do you believe her? Do you believe her? I believe her. I believe her. Matthew Dowd, I believe her. And Jonah Goldberg in a piece wrote, you know, it doesn't matter what people believe. It matters whether or not the accusation is true. And that's the essence of what we have here. And unfortunately for Blasey, I feel for her if something happened or if it did happen or whatever. But the reality is that she doesn't have any corroboration. Her, and a couple of lawyers told me that her going to her therapist and therapist notes, it would be considered evidence, although very flimsy evidence, but is not corroboration, meaning that there is nobody else that has been able to independently back up her story. Whereas Judge Kavanaugh has two people that have denied that this took place, two people that she named, you know, Mark Judge and then another guy, I can't remember his name, but he was another one. She said that he wasn't involved with what happened, but he was there. He said, no, I wasn't there. So the only corroborating witnesses are on Kavanaugh's side. And at the end of the day, you know, it's not going to be a matter of who anybody believes. She's going to have to make a compelling case if she does testify that what she's saying is true. And if he comes and he's going to sit there and deny it, And then it's a matter of who has presented the best case to make sure to prove that these allegations are true, not who you believe, because that's automatically, for the most part, being split right down the political middle. People who don't like Trump or Democrats, they believe her. Other side, they don't believe her. So that's the bottom line, is that, you know, absent any kind of corroborating evidence that can confirm what she said, I'm sorry, you can't sit there and react to Kavanaugh's nomination on the assumption that it is true.
Right, and I get really irritated this whole week when I would say, like, look, you know, people would argue back, like, if you said you're ruining a man's life, you're playing with a man's life, and people would say, like, oh, he gets to go back to his DC, you know, circuit court job, because he was, you know, and I said 2 weeks ago, I was like, if you think that he is this bad, you know, yes, he has a lifetime appointment, but how do people, you know, after his, you know, if his nomination gets pulled, or if he doesn't get, you know, onto the Supreme Court, which I don't think, I mean, I think he's going to get confirmed, but it's like, how do you then say, oh, well, he can just go back to sitting on the DC court? Like, people will go after him. The Maryland district attorney, I think, said that they're ready to you know, investigate and prosecute or whatever. The difference is that is his livelihood, and I'm talking about his life, and people are having a big, like, discrepancy and hard time, like, understanding that there is a difference between your livelihood and your life. His family is being trashed. His character is being trashed. And what have we seen? Not one really in-depth question about his, you know, over 200, what are they called? Opinions that he's written, you know, I mean,
that he's written, he's 300 cases he's heard since he's been on the DC circuit.
Yeah. So,
yeah, he has written a number of opinions for that court.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that too this week, Andrea, when people were saying, well, even if he's, you know, not confirmed, it doesn't matter, because he's this white guy who's had this just past that's filled with a bunch of privilege, and he's gone to these elite schools, and he's had this elite job and everything. It doesn't matter if he's never made uncomfortable for the rest of his life after this occurs. The thing that really matters is, like we've been talking about, is the truth. I don't care what happens in the future, whether it's, you know, if he sails off into the sunset and doesn't have to worry about anything, it's still the truth that matters, regardless of all these other circumstances. And yeah, I do obviously feel bad for Blasey, for whichever we're going to call her. I do think this is definitely an 11th hour attempt to stall the nomination, because the worst thing that Kavanaugh has going for him right now is he is the second nominee to the Supreme Court from one of the most polarizing, hated presidents ever, Donald mm-hmm. Trump. And he's in a position to where whoever was going to get in that spot was going to be demeaned and smeared, you know, regardless. And if it's true what she's saying, then of course I, you know, feel bad for her. But my opinion, from what we have on, you know, the evidence presented to us, or the non-evidence presented to us so far, is that this is an 11th hour attempt to smear and stall. And perhaps, I don't know, perhaps she's misremembering what happened. You know, I'm not going to get all Ed Whelan on us, but perhaps she's misremembering what occurred, and maybe it was someone else, and she doesn't have specific details about the exact place or the exact date. And, you know, that's a problem when we're looking at evidence 36 years down the road. So, I mean, it's just a mess, and we're going into the fourth week of talking about Kavanaugh.
Mm-hmm.
We really are.
Well, and just to think of how ridiculous it is. I was watching Morning Joe the other day, and what's her name? I tweeted about it. She's a Republican consultant, and she was on the show, and she said, I'm going to get killed. She goes, I'm going to get killed for this. She goes, but there is the possibility that this didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of environment we're in, where she just the mere suggestion that it didn't happen.
Believe all women.
Kind of creates this thing where it's like, oh my God, how dare you suggest that this didn't happen, you know? And I think it, you know, I don't know who wrote it. I think it might have been in that same Wall Street Journal editorial, or somebody else wrote it, where they were talking about, you know, this idea where we're just going to believe somebody because they make the because they're of their gender is isn't all that different from what we saw in the 50s and 60s when in the South you would believe the person who was white because they were white over the person who was black. Simple as that. I mean, that's the kind of environment that it is. And, you know, people are going to like probably be outraged about that. How dare you make that comparison? But it's not really a comparison. It's just the idea of saying, well, we're going to believe someone because of this one particular thing that they're women, they made the accusation. And I think it's also ironic considering how much the Keith Ellison accusations are being ignored. He actually said, who knows what women are going to cook up? He actually said that the allegations against him were cooked up, but there's no outrage out there.
And yet his accuser has, I think, a medical report from the time.
His medical reports and contemporaneous corroboration. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. I
mean, so going back, Jay, there one thing that did happen, and Kim mentioned it, the Ed Whelan thing. I mean, this was apparently Politico reported that it was pushed out by CRC Media, which is a PR group that helps mostly conservative. It's like, I think it is.
I'm familiar with them.
Yeah.
I get their emails like every other day.
Yeah. So
every day, like five times a day.
So do you just want to, can you like recap? I mean, this was a very like ill-fated attempt. Ugh. I mean, it was so bad. So
it's been worse.
Jay, do you just want to, like, for anybody listening that didn't follow it on Twitter?
Basically what the guy did, what Whelan did, who's a pretty well-respected kind of legal mind in the conservative community, decided to sit there and do some kind of, you know, that animated GIF with the guy that's doing the conspiracy stuff on the board with the string and everything attached to it. It's, like, similar to that. The guy was using, like, Google Maps and
Zillow
and everything to sit there and show how Kavanaugh couldn't have done this because if she was saying that, if, you know, Blasey was saying that the house was so far away from the club and here are houses, this is how far they lived away, and so it couldn't have been this house. And then what the worst part was is that he, like, you know, pointed the finger at some other guy who bears a, you know, kind of a similar resemblance to that of Brett Kavanaugh. The guy's like a grade school teacher somewhere, and he went to the school. And just like blamed him. Now, of course, the funny thing is that the people who were like lambasting, not all the people, because I think it was like pretty clear that this was kind of a stupid move. But one of the funnier things was, of course, members of the press doing it as well. Well, did Kavanaugh have any role in this? These are the same people who were just lambasting Whelan for sitting there pointing the finger at somebody for doing something, now sitting there wondering if Brett Kavanaugh had a hand in pushing this kind of thing out. It's like, will you stop with the stupid speculation and just say, okay, this was dumb, this was idiotic, you know, don't do that again. Instead of like trying to raise it, and then you had it's a woman who's like a former special prosecutor saying the FBI should investigate to determine whether or not Brett Kavanaugh played a role in pushing this theory out. And I quote tweeted, I'm like, right, the FBI is supposed to investigate a tweet thread. everybody's got the FBI these days doing their own personal little investigations that they want them to do.
Oh, well,
to some former prosecutor.
Well, that's exactly what I was. I was actually talking to my mom last night when she was here, and I was telling her, I was, you know, talking about the idea that the FBI is going to get involved in investigating a, you know, not a rape, a sexual assault, you know, from 30 years ago. You don't want the FBI getting involved in local, what should be local police matters. I mean, he's not, Brett Kavanaugh is not some super American citizen that, you know, gets the FBI called in. These are things, there is a purview and a jurisdiction, and this is not the FBI. Yes, the FBI is responsible for compiling a background check to submit to the Senate, but people are getting really, and I saw, I follow Busy Phillips, the actress, on Instagram, and she and a bunch of, you know, Hollywood people had this thing that they posted on their Instagram, which was like, "Dear Ivanka, you don't know me, but you can do, you say you're a feminist and you can do something and call for the FBI to do a full investigation into the allegations against Brett Kavanaugh." And I'm like, you don't want this standard being set. You do not want it. And it's the same thing with like when Mitch McConnell warned Harry Reid about getting rid of this filibuster, getting rid of, you know, back in the early 2010s, you know, that you will not like it when it's turned around on you. And I think that, you know, this is the kind of thing that everybody, you know, we just had John McCain pass away. And what I thought was so interesting and almost, you know, ironic about how, you know, the Democrats really like, you know, because, John McCain kind of went against Trump at every, you know, turn practically. John McCain was against, his main thing all the time was not about being against Trump. It was about the Republicans returning to process. He wanted the process restored. And that's why he turned his thumb down at the Obamacare overhaul. You know, it was over process, and it's just so interesting to me that the Democrats, you know, took McCain on as one of his own near the, you know, in the later years. But he was always just a guy who kind of like went by his own sail, and he was not on the Democrat side. He just stood with this like constant like process. I want the process restored. I want the process restored. And Republicans weren't restoring the process. They were continuing on down with this broken process. And that's what we're seeing now. And it's what even Ruth Bader Ginsburg and a lot of people and, you know, LA Times, I mean, you've got left and right agreeing this process is broken, and it's been broken for years now, if not decades. Like we had Noah Rothman on last week talking about, you know, what happened with Robert Bork, and Ben Sasse talking about how this has been this way since Robert Bork, and now it is, with the filibuster being gone, it is escalated to the most political, hyper-politicalization of Supreme Court nominees. And I don't know how you back off from this, so...
Yeah, and I brought this up before, but I looked up, before we had Noah Rothman on, I looked up the confirmation votes for other Supreme Court nominees in the past, and it just blew my mind, and I know I've said this before, but Scalia had 98 yes votes in the Senate, Kennedy had 97, and Ginsburg had 96. And obviously Ginsburg is, we would consider her to the left, Scalia to the right, and Kennedy, you know, well, he leans left, but, you know, maybe kind of in the middle. And those three were confirmed with pretty, you know, overwhelming, almost 100% in the Senate. And since then, we've had, let's see, Sotomayor was 68 yes votes, but the Republican votes for that were minuscule. Kagan, there were even fewer Republican votes for that. And then Gorsuch, he had 54 yes votes, overwhelmingly Republican, and only a handful of Democrats. And to see the tables, turn like that so much to where it's completely lopsided since, you know, we've had Ginsburg and Scalia and Kennedy, who are pretty polarizing in their own, you know, regard. But to see it go from where it's been to just a process-focused thing and not all these interest groups and not all these crazy people standing up in the background screaming, not all these accusations and smears, to go from the process focus, like you said, to where it is now, but it's just a partisan thing, is really amazing. And more than that, it's sad because, I mean, this one right here is bad, but can you imagine the next one, how that's going to be?
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, I was going to tweet about this last night, but this did not start with Kavanaugh. And the other one that you didn't mention was Stephen Breyer, who was confirmed 87-9, the other one of Clinton's Supreme Court nominees. So this didn't start with Kavanaugh. This goes back to 1988 and Robert Bork. So yes, Antonin Scalia was confirmed on a vote of 98-0. But then what happened was they didn't want, you know, the Democrats decided Reagan couldn't have another conservative appointed to the court. And so that is when Ted Kennedy took to the floor of the Senate, where they started using the Senate as a means of smearing people, and lashed out at Robert Bork, basically making it seem as if this guy was, you know, Bull Connor with a robe. Essentially, you know, that, you know, coat hanger abortions were coming back, mm-hmm. you know, being seated at different counters and different bathrooms and different water fountains was all going to come back if this guy was confirmed. And what happened was he was smeared so badly, he actually wound up not getting confirmed as a result. The full Senate voted against him. And he said, screw this. He was a district. He was on the D.C. circuit. He said, screw it. I'm out of here. I don't, you know, my reputation has been tarnished beyond repair. There's no point for me even going back to the court. This is a guy who was, you know, the famous, the American Bar Association was given the highest qualification. There is not anybody who could say that Bork was not qualified to sit on the Supreme Court, but they smeared him anyway. Then came Clarence Thomas. And everybody wants to sit there and say, well, Anita Hill was telling the truth. There were other witnesses that wanted to testify. No, there were other witnesses who were going to sit there and testify, not that they were also harassed by Thomas, but that they believed Anita Hill. Meanwhile, Thomas had four or five witnesses, female, who all said the accusations are garbage, that they never saw anything like that, and that there is no way that, anything like that happened. But yet that was still a damned circus. Then Clinton becomes president. What happens? His two Supreme Court nominees are pushed through the system just the way they had always been. Then George W. Bush becomes president. What happens? We start seeing
Harriet Myers.
Not Harriet Myers. It wasn't the Harriet Myers thing. It started with the lower courts where they started filibustering his nominees, blocking his nominees. Miguel Estrada was a nominee that was out there for years. Miguel Estrada's wife wound up committing suicide because of, you know, she probably already had some issues, but there was definitely tied to this, the smearing of this good person. And then, you know, then they tried to filibuster Samuel Alito after it was conservatives that kind of like reacted badly to the Harriet Myers nomination. And so then he turned around, he nominated Samuel Alito. Barack Obama was one of the ones that said he was going to filibuster the choice. He wound up getting through. Then Obama becomes president. And while it wasn't, you know, 90, like Kim was saying, it wasn't in the 90s or the 80s, the confirmation votes for Kagan or Sotomayor, it was still a very just straightforward process. So this, you know, this whole idea that they're doing this because they need to make sure and they'd be fully vetted. This is complete garbage. This has been for the last 30 years, coordinated political assassination attempts by the Democrats to have their way with judicial nominees submitted by Republicans. You want to sit there and say that it was a shame what happened to Merrick Garland? No, Merrick Garland was the result of what Democrats have been doing for 30 years before. And they went and they told President Obama, do not nominate somebody in an election year. We're not going to confirm him. And Obama went and did it anyway. If anybody has any kind of like apologizing to do to Merrick Garland, it should be Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Put him through that process knowing he wasn't going to get confirmed.
Yeah, and his name is still getting brought up. He's just like the constant, like, you know, rallying cry. The argument always goes back to Merrick Garland.
When you peel the layers back, when they sit there and start talking about Blasey and everything, once you keep peeling the layers, it always comes back to, well, what about Merrick Garland? I think that's what it always comes back to.
Jay, you've gotten 28 minutes on this topic. Well, besides the intro,
no quick recap.
Yeah. But, he needed to get it off his chest. He doesn't podcast anymore. No, he's like, so before I bang the gavel on this, I do want to ask you just up or down. Do you think that I am for the next Supreme Court nomination, if it's by a Republican or Donald Trump, that the hearings can be televised but closed to the public because the protesting is just so disruptive and gets nowhere. Kim, ladies first, do you think that they should be closed off at least to the public in the future for that reason?
Absolutely, make the handmaids feel like they're oppressed.
Jay?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and what you saw in that is a perfect argument against ever putting cameras inside the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. Okay, so the next topic that we had was last night. So we have, Jay, you've been probably inundated and seeing the Beto and probably, I hear that there's a lot fewer Cruz signs, which is to be expected. He's an incumbent, not completely liked all the time. But last night we had the first Beto Cruz debate, which I watched it and I was not impressed. But if you are changing your mind on a debate, you are just crazy. It did make me realize that Beto has some personal, like physical ticks that he does when he's speaking that annoy me. But the polling has been all over the place, and they've actually moved, you know, the Texas Senate race into
political
the
report, yeah.
Yeah, moved it to a toss-up. So, Jay, you want to just tell us a little bit about what's going on in Texas?
Okay, so... I have to be kind to my colleague Grummer Jeffers. He was the one of the ones who moderated the debate and works at Al Swarming News. So, and he's a great reporter. Unfortunately, and it's not his fault, and it's not the I didn't catch the name of the other debate moderator. But you know, unfortunately, the debate fell into this typical kind of thing where it seemed essentially like. And I said something on Twitter this morning, like, or on Facebook, like they were like repeating ad copy back and forth to each other. It wasn't like they were actually debating issues. I did also notice that Beto has this kind of like annoying kind of thing where he like jerks his body forward when he's talking. And it's almost as if when he does that, it seems like he's searching for the words. And so he does this kind of like animated, like lean forward so he can like express himself. Whereas Cruz is in his element when he's doing this stuff. He's just very unflappable, says a lot of different things. You know, it got, you know, of course, you come out this morning and you see the results and people saying, you know, oh, Cruz was lying when he said that Beto O'Rourke said something about, you know, accuse cops of being like the new Jim Crow and, you know, that kind of thing. And then, of course, you know, there's the whole style over substance. You know, Jennifer Rubin saying Beto O'Rourke looks like the guy that you'd want your niece to date or something stupid like that.
Yeah.
It was like one of the dumb things. I mean, my God, would this please stop calling her a conservative already? But going back to the debate, we didn't learn too much. And let's be honest, there is in Texas not a lot of like undecideds. This is not a situation where there's somebody actually sitting there saying, well, maybe I'll vote for Cruz or maybe I'll vote for Beto. I'm not sure which one I want to support yet. I mean, come on. Beto has this support. He's got the progressive left side, and he also has some of the anti-Trump Republican support out there. But here's his problem, and this goes back to what, you know, we saw during the primary. Ted Cruz, with almost no opposition, gathered more votes in his primary race than all of the Democratic Senate candidates combined in a primary, okay? So if Beto O'Rourke thinks that, you know, people think, I'm sorry, the Cook Political Report, having it tossed as a toss-up is a joke. There is not enough Democrats that can turn out that'll vote. And the other thing, and I've expressed this, and Andrea, I know you've talked about it as well, is that what you have, one of the things that you have in Texas is straight ticket voting. So essentially what you do is you go in, you get your ballot, and then you punch the Republican thing, and it automatically filters that down to every Republican on your ballot. That's all you do. There's going to be a lot of that because of the gubernatorial race. So what you're going to have is, the federal races are at the top, and then you have the governor's race. Greg Abbott has been leading Lupe Valdez in polls by like 15 to 20 points. It's going to be a blowout. You are not going to have people that are going to sit there and say, okay, I'm going to vote for Greg Abbott, but I'm not going to vote for Ted Cruz. You're just not going to split the ticket that way. This reminds me a lot of the Georgia races from 2014. Jimmy Carter's grandson ran for governor. And then Michelle Nunn, famous, a daughter of a famous, you know, kind of like an icon in Georgia, Sam Nunn, who was a senator there. Both of them running, both of them with the polls were close. They were closer within points all the way through. And then at the end, when it came election day, they both lost by 8 points. And I think that's going to be the same thing here. Beto's hype has largely been media driven. As this campaign goes down for the last like 30, 40 days or whatever, it's like you have his positions, his policy positions being opened up and people getting more of a look at it. When you're sitting there saying, I don't think anyone should own an AR-15, when you say that in Texas, that's not a good political strategy. And I'll go on the record now as I'll say this. I think that Cruz will probably win between by 7 or 9 points. It's not going to be close.
Yeah.
As for the debate, I don't want to see anymore, because if they're both going to be, if the other two are going to be like the one last night, it's kind of like, it wasn't, there's no substance there. I mean, granted, again, I don't think you're going to be changing anybody's mind, but it'd be nice to see them really kind of like dig into the details of important issues that they're discussing, not worrying about what somebody said about, you know, Jim Crow and what another person said about this. You know, it's just kind of silly.
So I didn't watch much of the debate, but I got a little taste of it. And like you were saying, Jay, it's not so much substance. Just like most debates, they're pretty, you know, entertaining, but everyone has most likely already made up their mind in regards who they want to, you know, vote for. But two things that jumped out to me, that I was doing stuff in the background and listening to it, but they asked Ted Cruz about essentially how he could be so supportive of the president and his agenda when the president had, you know, on the campaign trail said stuff about his wife. And then Ted Cruz gave an answer. And then they also asked Beto about his drunk driving arrest in 1998, I believe, and about him leaving the scene. And then he said that he didn't leave the scene and kind of went from there. But it's odd, those two questions, because of course, they're not really substantive, except maybe the Beto thing was probably a little bit more. But it really talks about, I guess, the character of the individual. But people kind of already have their own, you know, ideas made up in their mind about how these individuals are, these candidates are. And obviously, I think all of us maybe were frustrated when Cruz kind of bowed to the president after he had said certain things on the campaign trail. But he did, to his credit, Cruz talked about how he's worked with the president to make sure things are right for the American people and for the people of Texas. So I think his answer, you know, was pretty good as far as that's concerned. But Beto, like I said, he mentioned that he did not leave the scene of the accident. Mm-hmm. But the police report mentions that he attempted to flee the scene. And so that, I mean, that's another big question mark. And some people might look at that and say, well, it was in 1998. It doesn't really matter. He's learned from them, you know, that mistake and everything. But Beto, first of all, he said he didn't leave the scene. And then, like a politician, he took the answer to this question about his personal life several years ago, and he turned it around to say that Black Americans, Black men, should not be, you know, unjustly focused on just because of their race by police. And of course that's true, but he made it this whole Black men are, you know, incarcerated more than in white men thing. And it was an odd answer to a question that had nothing to do with that. It had everything to do with his own personal life. Obviously he's trying to shine the spotlight elsewhere and kind of turn it around, the question around, and make it sort of show how much he cares for the people of the state. But I thought that was very odd. And then today, Ted Cruz, let's see, what time was it? He tweeted a little video, last night at like 6:18, but it was, all it says at the top is, in Beto O'Rourke's own words, and then # Texas Senate debate. And it's about a minute clip of Beto speaking at an African-American church. And Beto's talking about the shooting, of course, with both Gene, I think is how you say his last name. Maybe I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. But we're still learning, you know, about the specifics behind that and the officer who thought it was her apartment and shot him dead, and a horrible tragedy, and she should be held accountable for that. But Beto's speaking at this Black church about how Black men shouldn't be dying at the hands of white officers. And it's this little clip, and I don't disagree with anything that he's saying in the clip. I mean, it's a short little clip. I think most Americans would look at that and say, well, yeah, people like both of them who were gunned down and shouldn't have been at all, that's terrible. And it's murder. I mean, whether she's actually charged with murder or something else, but it shouldn't have occurred. So it was odd to me that Ted Cruz would tweet this clip and say, in Beto O'Rourke's own words. I mean, is he agreeing with Beto? Is he disagreeing? I don't know why he would be disagreeing, but it has right now 15,000 comments, because I think people are confused as to what he was trying to do. So I thought that was kind of an odd matter, and it kind of leaves more questions than answers.
Right. Well, Jay, well, you kind of explained this to me. Yeah.
Well, the only thing that I can think that it picked out of that ad is that he Beto said, you know, white cops shooting unarmed Black men, when in reality a study was done showing that the issue of people getting shot who are unarmed is an institutional issue, that, you know, minority cops are just as likely to shoot an unarmed suspect as a white cop, you know. So was that what he was taking out of it? I don't know.
No, I think I
should have added some description.
I think this is about the gym. There was a part. I don't. And Kim.
No. This is a different video.
Oh,
this is only like 59 seconds long, and it doesn't. Yeah, I listened to it twice.
This was not the Jim Crow thing. The Jim Crow thing is separate. That was a separate video where he was at a town hall and he said all these things. And he said, and somebody said, and I think this is an apt description, this is the new Jim Crow. So he's like saying, well, I didn't say that this is the new Jim Crow, you know. And so it's kind of like that thing with, you know, like with Trump, where it's like, well, I didn't say it. It's just something I saw on the internet, you know. But let me ask you this, Kim. When they were talking about the drunk driving thing, did he say, I didn't leave the scene, or I didn't try to leave the scene?
Let me pull that up.
That's interesting, because if he said
right here, yeah, quote, I did not try to leave the scene of the accident. The drunk driving drunk, which I did, is a terrible mistake, et cetera, et cetera.
All right, well, I mean, there's a police report that says a witness says he did. We should find out if the witness is female, because if she is, we have to believe her.
No, I mean, it really is, you know, I mean, I think that the entire thing was just, yeah, like you said, I do not need to watch another one of these. I don't know why they want another one of these, you know. I do think that, gosh, the thing that annoyed me about Ted Cruz, you know, he was being Ted Cruz or whatever, and at the very end, they wanted the moderator asked them each to say something nice about the other person, and Beto actually said this really nice thing about how, you know, Ted Cruz has given up a lot of his time with his family to be, you know, a good public servant, and Ted Cruz went low and had to talk about, oh, you really believe, you know, I admire you. I mean, you really, we disagree on, you believe in bigger government and socialism and stuff like that. But, you know, I honor you for you know, sticking up for the things that you believe in. And then, you know, ran that home. And I did kind of like the fact that Beto said true to form.
The debate brought back a lot of, sorry. Yes, Jay. I was going to say the debate brought back a lot of memories from the 2016 presidential election cycle, which I watched all those debates, but you forget how horrible they are, yet how much you want to look at the screen, but how you can't turn away because it's just
a train wreck, right?
It's a train wreck. There's going to be a bunch of sound bites from it. And like we're saying, there's not much substance, but my gosh, you get to see how these people really are.
Yeah. Well, the problem is, and Kim, you brought it up, is that, you know, the questions that were asked, and here's the problem. The problem is having journalists moderate the debates, because journalists are going to ask questions that journalists are going to ask. What they should do, bring in somebody who nobody knows. Bring in a no-name person who moderates like college debates, and who are going to ask questions that are going to force the candidate to actually respond to something with some substance. I mean, because why is the relevance of Beto's drunk driving incident relevant to the debate? It's not. Is it relevant to the race? Yes, but in a political sense, and leave it out there. It's not something that should be part of a debate. It's not a debate issue. That's a political issue. That's a character issue that people can decide on separately. But let's find out what they think about North Korea. I mean, that's actually a little bit more important.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you're up for a, you know, position where you are one of 100 people in this country, you know, and that is actually a vaunted position. Even though we sit around saying like, oh, they're just one senator, you know, it's like, oh, Ben Sasse is just one senator. Oh, Ted Cruz is just one senator. But they are actually one of a very few people in a certain position, that, and that is holding a statewide office. So,
and we see how much one senator, we see how much one senator matters in light of the Kavanaugh stuff.
Yes.
I mean, it really does matter.
Yes. Good point.
All right. So we've pretty much covered all of that. We kind of went into the Botham Jean thing. I thought that we were going to have more to talk about on Botham Jean and Amber I can't think of her last name. Starts with a G. Do you guys?
Geiger? Is that one?
Geiger, yeah. Anyways, but there actually hasn't been too much on that this week. So we'll see how that kind of plays out. It'll be one of the more, it's one of the more interesting cop shootings, which wasn't, you know, she wasn't in her capacity as a cop, but she certainly acted, she was operating, as, you know, in that mode. But we will do some food policing here, Kimberly. We have brought, it is well known that J. Crusoe engages in food Twitter and expressing strong opinions about food. And Jay, you have
strong incorrect opinions.
Yes. So we're going to do some policing here. So first of all, the lemon dessert thing, Jay, you're not right on this. And I understand. So you don't like lemon desserts, which Kim and I love.
Yeah, we both love those. Those are so good.
And then I believe sweet tea. You are a sweet tea preference person.
Yeah, who the heck drinks unsweetened tea?
It's me and disgusting. Kim.
I do.
Yeah.
So does Andrew.
You can drink your unsweetened tea with your lemon desserts.
Yes, exactly. We sit.
The rest of us live in America.
But that's not even okay. Those are not even the worst food opinions that apparently Jay holds. Because Andrea,
you live in the South, Kim.
Jay, thanks. Okay,
living in the South and not sweet tea. Mississippi is going to want you to leave.
She's from Illinois.
Andrea, would you like to mention this horrible, horrible opinion that's way worse than sweet tea or not liking lemon desserts?
Jay said publicly that he would try mayo chup, which is Heinz ketchup with mayonnaise mixed. And I'm sorry, but that is what you can, like, we used to be civilized.
It's un-American?
It's like, would you ever try, did you ever try that? Like the peanut butter and jelly in a container together that I would never touch that. Jay, how can you why would you, for someone who has
haven't you ever eaten a burger with mayo and ketchup on it? Have you ever eaten a Whopper? Whoppers have, if you've ever eaten a Whopper from Burger King, it has mayo and ketchup on it.
Okay, no. but see, that my big thing is Heinz. I guess it's more of a brand thing. Like the Heinz ketchup is you know, the good ketchup, but then you don't get Heinz mayonnaise. Heinz mayonnaise isn't good. What brand are they using? Because the only brand of mayonnaise that our family even uses is Best Foods, which is / Hellman's. So it's the same company, same brand, but just different name for different places. But like, I don't eat mayonnaise that often, but it's like pre-mixing it sounds disgusting.
Oh, yeah. First of all, I don't eat mayonnaise. I don't like them very much. If I'm going to do anything, and you both are probably going to hate me, I like Miracle Whip.
Because you're my sister.
God.
It tastes better. But then, let's set that aside. We're talking about mayo chip right now. Just the name, mayo chip, it just sounds like someone is vomiting.
Oh, I know.
And I cannot stand to read that word or even hear that word. It's just the worst.
Okay. Last.
I would only put it on a burger. I wouldn't eat it for anything else. Like, there are going to be people who are going to, like, use this stuff and, like, dip their french fries in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no. But I know plenty of, like, Canadians and stuff like that that dip their what they call chips into mayonnaise. And, you know, first they cover it with vinegar and then they dip it in mayonnaise.
Well, they're Canadian.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they do in Europe, too. So it reminds me of Pulp Fiction when John Travolta says that to... He's like, you know what they put on french fries in Europe instead of ketchup? Mayonnaise. And Samuel Jackson's like, ugh.
Yeah. So last...
They fucking drown him in that shit. There you go. So I cursed on your podcast.
So last but not least is... We all know that the more toppings a pizza has, the better it is, especially when you're talking about onions and mushrooms and peppers and sausage.
Oh, amen.
And Jay, you just want pepperoni, and that's it. And that's just
Or does yeah, you just want look. Cheese sometimes?
Yeah, yeah.
That too. Pizza
it's bread
is,
with cheese.
Pizza is simplicity. That's what's the best part about pizza is that it's a very simple kind of food. It's dough, it's cheese, and it's sauce, and that's pretty much it. If you're gonna have toppings, yeah, I can eat onions, or I could eat pepperoni, or I could eat sausage or something like that. But if you're going, but piling on a whole bunch of stuff, olives and mushrooms and everything, it's no longer pizza. It then becomes kind of like some
pizza?
Kind of. It becomes like it's like an open faced sandwich.
Oh my
you know,
goodness.
It's not pizza anymore.
So now pizza is a sandwich. If you fold it in
no,
half
no,
and have
I
a
said,
bunch.
No, I said it's what they call an open face sandwich. Again, this is, you Canadians don't know anything about these things. But over on the East Coast, open face, like pot roast sandwiches and turkey sandwiches are a thing. So that's essentially what it comes down to with pizza, is that it's no longer – pizza has to be a situation where you can pick up a slice and you can fold it and you can eat it. You can't do that with all that crap on there that's just going to spill all over the place.
Oh, sure. You
First
can.
Of all, I don't –
And if you tell me that you eat your pizza with a knife and a fork, I'm hanging up and I'm never speaking to you again.
I have one hand. I have to. Sorry, Kim. Go ahead.
First of all, I don't really want to take food opinions from someone who thinks mayo chip is a good idea. And no, I don't eat my pizza with a knife and fork. I eat it with just a fork.
Yes.
And I love doing
exactly.
that.
Oh,
you know
exactly.
Oh, my God.
Even before my accident, I ate pizza with a fork because I don't like my fingers getting all greasy.
No, exactly. Oh, and if you have a lot of toppings, you have to pick them up.
That's because you're not eating real pizza. That's the problem. If you're just eating regular, real, New York-style pizza. Everybody could sit there and talk about, you know, Jon Stewart being like this liberal kind of thing, and he was always picking on conservatives. But the greatest thing that he ever did on The Daily Show was when he sat there and went off on Chicago style pizza, which he called as a casserole, which is perfect. It's a big pile of goop, mm-hmm. and compared it to New York style, you know, thin crust pizza. And at the end, he did exactly what you're supposed to do. He grabbed a slice of pizza, he folded it, and he took a bite. That's pizza.
whatever.
All right, Jay, thank you very much for coming on and hijacking so our half of our podcast for Kavanaugh again.
Hey.
And hey, Jay, where can we reach you?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Jay Caruso, and you can find my unsigned editorials at the Dallas Morning News.
All right, Kim, where can everybody find you?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Southern Keeks, at Red State, and at Washington Examiner.
All right, and you can find me at Andrea and Ruth on Twitter and at redstate.com. One more week of Kavanaugh, but we are off next week. So this is our last podcast for September, because I will be in Austin watching, well, we'll see if I watch Jay Caruso's panel.
Hopefully when we come back. Oh jeez. Hopefully when we come back it won't be Kavanaugh still.
Yeah, maybe it'll be over. I know, I really want it. I'm like, please let this all be over by the time that I leave on Wednesday morning for Austin. So but anyways. Oh, sorry.
Associate Justice Kavanaugh.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe I'll we'll come back and it'll be Associate Justice Kavanaugh. Yeah.
Yes. Amen.
Oh, it'd be so nice to have that over with. And then we can get full swing into you know, we're only 40 days or 45 days, something like that, away from the election. So it's going to be we're in the runoff. So anyway, so, you know, we'll see you in October, everybody. Have a nice weekend. Bye.